Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Dr. Michael Sartiski, President and Executive Director of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, and editor of A Unique Slant of Light, the Bicentennial History of Art in Louisiana. We'll also hear from poet Carolyn Hembree, whose new book is called Skinny. Dr. Michael Sartiski is the president and executive director of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. He's the founder of that gorgeous magazine, Cultural Vistas, and his commitment to literacy is evident in the success of the LEH's award-winning Primetime Family Literacy Program, which has been replicated all across the country. But today, we'll be talking about his love of art. The LEH has partnered with the State Bicentennial Commission to produce a new and very beautiful book, A Unique Slant of Light, The Bicentennial History of Art in Louisiana. Dr. Sartiski, along with J. Richard Gruber and John Kemp, edited this volume. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Susan. Delighted to be here.
Ah, welcome. Congratulations on this gorgeous new book, which will be unveiled at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art Friday, September 15th.
Well, we are so delighted to have birthed this baby, I can tell you right
and
now.
And she's a big one.
And she is. Okay.
So tell us how and when this project began.
I have to credit Randy Haney, who is a member of the Bicentennial Commission for the state of Louisiana, for this celebration. Randy had approached Rick Gruber, who, as you know, was the founding and now the emeritus director of the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. But Rick, by that point, had retired from the Ogden and was without the institutional support to be able to carry this off with the staff effort that was going to be required. And so he approached me and the LEH to see if we wanted to partner on this. But it was Randy Haney who put it in motion. Rick Gruber, who really is the intellectual giant of this project, along with John Kemp, the deputy director emeritus of the LEH itself and himself an art historian. Mm-hmm. My period of academic training was late 19th, early 20th century. And one of the things, Susan, that we did with this volume, which is beyond the normal scope of what an art book does, is to contextualize it and to put the art in its historical moment, both in the evolution of art itself and its various genres, but also the entire surround of the economy, the changes in society, the changes in politics, even changes in technology, because with the advent of photography, art itself changed.
Oh, right. That's very evident. Now, the statistics are really astounding for this book. You have 276 entries on Louisiana artists and 400 amazing reproductions of images.
Yes, we do. Working and consulting with scholars and institutions throughout the state, we identified, and I will tell you, there was very little exclusion as to who we decided was worthy of inclusion in a commemorative book like this. And the 276 major entries are of those artists running literally from the very founding of the Louisiana Territory and the city of New Orleans to the present day, and contemporary artists predominate. History is already past judgment, if you will, on many of those in the late 18th and into the 19th century. And the 20th century has really witnessed just this incredible surge of activity. And we try to encompass that.
I want you to describe that selection process when you all were sitting in the office looking at images and deciding what to include.
Well, the selection process wasn't so much excluding individual artists, of which there were very few done by intent. I have no doubt that people are going to be flagging people that we should have included, and had we known of them, we might have, but that's water under that bridge. But choosing the images for each artist, I mean, was a Sophie's choice multiplied over and over. And sometimes I had to look, together with my senior media editor, Andrea Ferguson, who did this copious research, at dozens and dozens of images and then have to choose one that we felt not only was, in our judgment, a glorious work of art, but also was representative of what that artist was trying to express.
And one of the interesting things about this is that you have taken this artisan-like care with the way every page looks, with the way the volume itself looks. And there's this kind of two-pronged, amazing combination of old-fashioned care with the book and pushing the book forward into the digital future. So talk a little bit about your thinking about that.
Well, this project was basically composed on one extreme with a fountain pen. Would have used a quill if I had one. Mm-hmm. And at the other extreme, okay, the most advanced computers and digital technology that was available to us. At the core of it, like everything we do at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, was scholarship. This is where Rick Ruber, John Kemp, Teresa Ferris Parker from Tulane, Susan Tucker, Eric Bookhart, and then literally scores of other scholars gave us the core of the knowledge. The principal collections and art museums and archives around the state then opened up all their treasures to us, and from them we got to select all these works of art. We wanted this, very chauvinistically, to be as much as possible an All Louisiana project. And we, rather than save money by having it printed as so many books are today in China or Singapore or even Canada, we elected to go with Garrity Press, which has been printing Louisiana Cultural Vistas for us for over two decades. And they brought a sensibility about varnishes and how to compose colors and achieve accuracy to matte the part of the page that has the print on it, to push the print forward, and at the same time to put a brighter varnish over the images themselves so that they come leaping out of the page and the colors are made even more living and vivid. Kevin Alker and his staff at Garrity Press, you know, brought something really crucial. And especially in these late stages when production problems arose, and with Isaac we actually encountered a last-minute one, we had people so deeply devoted to this that they made, even in this day and age, a print project of this magnitude possible.
Wow. And so if you love art books, you'll open this up and you'll get that incredible smell of the new book. And then you'll turn the pages and admire the art in the best old-fashioned kind of art book loving experience. But then if you want to move forward or learn more, what you've done here is really remarkable.
Well, we're very proud of this. This is a cutting-edge project that bridges the traditional genre of printing and our creating, in this instance, this enormous 8 or 9 pound print artifact of 450 pages. We then digitize this book. And when you go to the digital version of it online, Susan, where we were restricted and had to make those Sophie's choices of finding a single representative image for Clegg or Buck or Clarence John Loughlin, if you click on the digital page in the book, it'll lead you to NOLA, the Digital Encyclopedia of Louisiana History and Culture, one of our other major projects. And when you go to the NOLA entry on any one of those artists, instead of being restricted to a single image and a 200-word capsule biography, you will be directed to a NOLA entry of 1,500 to 2,000 words of a biography, and in addition, an image gallery that in some instances will have several dozen representative pieces, not just the one that we had to choose for the book. Then those artists are also have links embedded in those biographies to the larger issues, whether it's the Civil War or Reconstruction, the advent of women in the workforce in the 20th century. All of those enormously important issues of the cultural surround can be even further elaborated in NOLA, as we were able to initially do in the introductory essays in the book.
So the educational possibilities are really endless with this.
And quite literally, because NOLA also includes a module in which every single subject is literally linked to the Louisiana Department of Education grade level expectations, and there will be lesson plans, opportunities for teachers or students to consult with scholars and ask questions. And again, we go from the most traditional of print artifacts into all of the interactive abilities and constant linkages of concepts and ideas and knowledge, and then even redirecting back to the original host institutions from which we obtained these images. Mm-hmm. And it all is held together seamlessly.
Every book is rock bottom, a labor of love. You know that, and I know that. And you began life as an English professor, and I know that you are polymorphous and perverse, as you're fond of saying. But you especially love art. I've seen your art collection. I know that there are things you love, and you have this great visual sensibility. So tell us a little bit about the favorite artists that are in this book of yours.
Well, it's difficult to say, and I have to give credit to people like Roger Ogden, to Arthur Roger, Michael Wilkinson, another collector, Randy Haney himself, and Rick Ruber. I mean, people have been generous with me, and we learned things in the course of this project that I didn't know before. I'm a professor of English by training and profession, Susan, but Louisiana is, as you know, so well, is one of the most sensuous cultures on earth, and certainly in the United States. And the visual richness of evening light, and that's what spoke to these artists. I mean, the luminosity of especially the landscapes. Now, there's a lot of idealization. One of the things we talk about is ways in which a lot of the art didn't confront the realities of the time. Art performs multiple functions for a culture and a society, and some of it is documentary, some of it is commemorative, and some of it, quite frankly, is escapist. And that enormous complexity and richness is represented here. Personal favorites, Richard Clegg, who was really the father of the Bayou School, his vision of what the possibilities were of the Louisiana landscape. A lot of people who've never experienced Louisiana go, swamps, marshes? I mean, come on, you know, we got the Rocky Mountains, we got the Adirondacks, you know, I mean, that's just awful stuff. They saw the beauty, they captured the sense of light. We titled the book, right, A Unique Slant mm-hmm. of Light. Of course, that's an oblique homage to Emily Dickinson and her notion of a certain slant of light. But it was also a recognition of that characteristic that pervaded work after work after work of just the lushness and the ways in which, and whether it's portraits in a domestic milieu or more particularly those landscapes. And I have to say, it's the landscapes that truly sang to me.
Wow. I remember when you led the panel discussion at the Tennessee Williams Festival about this book, and you were there with Roger Ogden and George Rodrigue, and someone asked George about his painting, and we were talking, I think, specifically about the landscapes, and he said that what drew him in over and over again was the mystery.
The mystery, and George in that same presentation talked about when you come off of the Texas plains and the flatlands mm-hmm. and you move into Louisiana and you have this sense of the encircling oaks, and it creates a different sensibility that is more about enclosure and interiority that pulls us in and it arches over us. I would observe a little wryly that it also leads us to lack a bit of perspective. We don't see broad vistas, and we become very fond of ourselves and very enclosed, and the art very much, you know, reflects that. But George, coming as he does from the Lafayette area, and of course people think mostly of the Blue Dog, but another motif that has pervaded his work and is, in my opinion, even more powerful than the Blue Dog is the dark oak and, right. and the way in which the live oak and that looming darkness and embrace, not ominous, just rich and resonant, is one of the ways in which I think George Rodrigue really does capture part of the essence of Louisiana culture and identity.
Oh, yes. Well, this is a book that's going to make everybody want to stand up and cheer. I just know it. You can meet Michael Sartiski and his co-editors and contributors when A Unique Slant of Light, The Bicentennial History of Art in Louisiana, is unveiled at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art Friday, September 14th at 6 p.m., and they'll be appearing again Saturday, September 15th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you, Susan. You have always been the natural resource of the literary consciousness of Louisiana.
Take the highway. I see you in my
Hambry started out to be an actress, but luckily for all of us, she became a poet instead. She's lived in New Orleans since 2001 and teaches here at the University of New Orleans. She lives in Carrollton with her husband, her daughter Mamie, and two rescue dogs. Skinny is the name of her first poetry collection, and it is sharp, 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 filled with compelling voices and powered by a dreamy sensibility. Welcome to The Reading Life, Carolyn.
Hi, Susan.
You decided to start writing poetry on a ride home from Emily Dickinson's house in Amherst. Tell us about that moment.
That was a visit that I took after I'd spent several years in New York attempting to pursue a career in acting. I say attempting to pursue rather than pursuing because I didn't know what I was doing at all. I didn't really pursue getting an agent. I had no idea of the kinds of roles I should be cast for or would be cast for. So I just didn't know what I was doing, but I kept doing it for a long time. And then working as a paralegal in various law firms, and I didn't like that at all. And being a receptionist and just these odd jobs. So I had done that for a while, and I'd always wanted to make a pilgrimage to Amherst. And also went on a leg to Boston, where her original writing table is, as well as some manuscripts. So on the way back, it really was a moment of epiphany where I knew I wanted to go somewhere and write. And the most practical way to carve out time for that and step into a community that was healthy and at that time well-funded, as well as having various mentors, was to step into an MFA program. And Arizona was a wonderful fit for me.
So you went from the Northeast back to the desert.
I went to the desert, which is a good place to write. Tucson is surrounded by mountains. I was really awed by it, struck by it, but I did not feel at all comfortable there, at home. I didn't like it as far as the environment was not. I don't camp out. I don't climb mountains. I don't do that kind of thing. So I'm a Southern girl. I wanted to get back south, but it was the perfect place to write because what I had was my memories of the South and of how I'd grown up and all of those things. They were not immediate. And so in trying to kind of reach for them mentally, psychologically, that was, I think, what I needed at the time. But I loved the program. And studying in these little adobe cottages, it was just amazing. Loved it.
Sometimes that fresh place puts everything in relief for you, you know, I think. And then I read that the first poem of Skinny came to you in a dream.
It was in a dream. And oddly enough, I don't think this will ever happen again in my life. The first poem of the book, A Real Movie Star, is also the first poem that I conceived for this. And yeah, it was part of a dream, parts of it, and the voices that are interacting, the vision that I saw in the dream. I was also reading a lot of John Berryman at the time.
Dream songs, yes.
Right. And sort of imitating his syntax in my spare time, as well as Adrienne Rich's. So yes, that did come in a dream.
So tell us about Skinny and Bird and Mamie, some of these incredible voices in these poems.
They are voices. I like that way of putting it. It makes me really comfortable, more so than calling them characters. I recently finished a second manuscript where I would definitely say I have characters. They're still poems, but they're characters. Occasionally I write in persona, but these are voices, and they were actually conceived as voices. So when I wrote these poems, I spoke aloud the whole time that I was writing them. It was probably the first time since leaving acting and performance and that pursuit. I was devastated when I had to pack it in and leave New York, you know, to admit that I had failed. And I had. It's not something we like to say about ourselves, but the fact was I had failed as an actor. And so to admit that to myself, I spent a long time as a writer trying to be Louise Glück or Merwin or this lyric sort of elevated idea of a poet, these poets I looked up to, but I'm not. It's not a truth for me. So in speaking aloud and sort of almost a method acting approach to writing is how Skinny and Bird were conceived.
And Skinny and Bird are always talking to each other. So tell us about these voices. To me, there's this kind of bluesy,
smart sensibility, this kind of way down, low down feeling you get reading these poems. And so what was it like for you to live with these voices?
It was actually kind of dark, mm-hmm. I would say, but oddly playful, sort of fantastical in a way. There's somewhere between the idea of make-believe play of childhood and dream and sleepwalking and sexual connection. There was sort of that feeling throughout this. It was very intense, but some of it very addictive and joyful to be inside of that world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me talk to you about why Corray Press publishes women. And this is in the back of all their books, which I love. Since its inception in 1923, Time magazine has never had a female editor. Since 1948, the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction has gone to 42 men and 16 women. Of the 108 Nobel Prize winners in literature, 12 have been women. Three of the 12 female winners were in the last decade. So that must make you feel very good about their commitment to your work.
Yes. I've known about them for a long time, since I was in Tucson, actually, is when I would go and I'd check out their events and hear their readings. But it's easy to forget because women have such a presence at conferences, because I have female colleagues who are very important to me, because I'm friends with so many female poets and writers whom I trust. It's easy to forget that on the larger scale, that's not reflected. In fact, VIDA.org, V-I-D-A, recently did some pie charts on, I believe it was the 2011 publications, Boston Review, Newsweek, all of that stuff, to look at how many men and how many women are both being used as reviewers and published or writers who are being published. And it's absolutely jaw-dropping to see.
I remember those. It was just staggering to me after all this time. So what have you brought to read for us today? What poem would you choose to read?
I'm going to read one that opens the second section of the collection. The book is sort of a coming-of-age journey. And this takes place once Skinny and the speaker, the poet, have taken off from the South and landed in the big city, and there is an encounter. Old sweetheart slams white Russians and mudslides on Dittmar's Boulevard, Astoria. First words out of my mouth, he say, "My, my, you're not from around here." Every bone cry, "Hie you hence." But in uniform, he's out of this world. Brass chicken hawk on brick wall exposed, read 50 degrees. Truly, I want a shortcut to the innermost workings of one other. Says, "You take your chances running night operations, I say goddamn." Bird's eye view of his fingers spread out on his crown, flesh wound. Through three shot glasses, the waitress's fingers loop. Clapping off the beat, he guffaw. "You dance like a country girl." Flush. To the beaten path of his hand in the pile of my skirt go. Towards the southernmost row houses. Turn at the spicy restaurant, its awning ruffling. There one woman lends another her rabbit fur. Dream. A man at the end station at the crack of dawn to sing and flaunt. Now, whether to sing or tell it other ways. Leastways atop the gratings, a man dance with a puppet life size, its arms to his waist tied. "Hot little number," he say, and has it say, "Caramba," while the train skates in and speakers crackle live. My sheets snapped flat and train case crammed. "I never answered you. Losing your mind, scrambling in the grass down. Asking me years hence, why don't you sound now like where you're from? No, you just looking hard at me. The voice is from elsewhere thrown."
Wow, all those years of acting paying off.
Thanks.
Don't you feel that energy as a performer? Don't you feel that pleasure
in
saying the words? It's just, you know, so many people say the poem isn't finished until it's heard. Do you feel that way?
I certainly think it's one part of the journey. I don't know if it gets finished.
Maybe not. Well, I want Skinny and Bird to keep talking. You can meet Carolyn Hembree at the book launch for Skinny. It's sponsored by Room 220 and takes place at 7 p.m. Thursday, September 13th at the Lipstick and Lingerie Boutique in Araby at 7011 St. Claude Avenue, just past Jackson Barracks. Thanks so much, Carolyn.
Thank you, Susan.
Come on, Skinny Love, just let's see.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Maple Street Bookshop's Downtown Book Club discusses Salvage the Bones by Jessamyn Ward, Tuesday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at Fatouche, downstairs from the bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. William Barnwell discusses and signs Lead Me On, Let Me Stand, Thursday, September 13th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. David Lummis signs The Coffee Shop Chronicles Part 2, Thursday, September 13th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Carolyn Hembree, signs Skinny, sponsored by Room 220 at 7 p.m. Thursday, September 13th at the Lipstick and Lingerie Boutique in Araby, 7011 St. Claude, just past Jackson Barracks. Jamie Bernstein and Bill Lavender are the featured readers in the 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series reading, Thursday, September 13th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Today's guest, Michael Sartiski, along with Rick Gruber and John Kemp, celebrate the publication of A Unique Slant of Light, The Bicentennial History of Art in Louisiana, Friday, September 14th at 6 p.m. at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and again, Saturday, September 15th, from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Cornell Landry signs The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo, and Bonnie Shoemaker signs The Story of Palilu, a pelican who survived the Gulf of Mexico oil, Saturday, September 15th, from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Cornell Landry also signs The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo, Saturday, September 15th at 2 at Octavia Books, followed by Myra McIntyre signing Timepiece at 4 p.m. And Jeff Weiss reads from and signs his story collection, How, September 18th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.